Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I am Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Jumble Justice Radio Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I hope you've discovered and enjoyed the many, many opportunities to hear radio programs on everything imaginable on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and thank you for joining us tonight. I was looking at some of the data about our shows and sites, and my gosh, we've been doing this show for 3 years and 2 months, and when I said that to Emily here before the show started, my goldfish, Harold, he dived for the bottom of the tank and bounced off the bottom when he heard that we've been doing this for 3 years, but he's a loyal fan. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm your host, Keith Haley, as I said, and we want to thank Johnny Cash again for taking us on that marvelous trip across the country to so many different places, 90 different cities and states, and yes, he does sing that song from memory. And one of these nights, we're threatening to sing it ourselves, aren't we, Emily, Mike, Audrey? Audrey already knows it, but that's a hard one to sing from pure memory. The purpose of our show is the same as it is every week for the past 3 years. We try to discuss news issues, events, and developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We don't exactly have any straight humor stories tonight, but a couple of them are funny when you stop and think about, no, Emily, I'm not in trouble for that. Well, I guess I should say that already. You know, our Transportation Security Agency, as part of Homeland Security, accidentally released their security manual on the Internet this past week. And I think it was a New York Times article that I was reading that allowed me to download their entire security manual. It's something like 93 pages, as I recall. Might be a little bit more than that. And also I was able to downloads a little package of information about half that size about the CIA and their credentials and how they fly. So I hope we've got that all patched up. But they said it's not as bad as we thought, that some of that information wasn't quite that critical. But it seems like that's a little bit of a lapse. It's been a bad week for Homeland Security, you know, after the party crashing where the guests came to the President Obama's party without being on the guest list. But anyway, they'll get better, and they work very hard. I've known people in that Secret Service organization, in White House Police, one of the graduates in the program I used to work for years and years ago. John went right to the White House Police and worked, and that's part of the Secret Service now, but he used to be a separate type of entity. Well, anyway, this show we dedicate it to those tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and throughout the world. What we try to do on this show is look inside criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professionals as they do their job. Tonight's going to be a bit of a switch. We've never done anything like this, and we're really entering an area. I know you're going to say this is many areas, but for me, I'm going to say an area that I don't know a whole lot about. But tonight we're going to deal with Bernie Madoff and his imperfect crime, as they're calling it. And Bernie Madoff was the one that did the stock swindles, the largest single swindle in the history of crime. And I think you'll enjoy this this story because it involves some details. And Fortune actually did the analysis and created the audio that we're going to be playing tonight. But that should be very interesting if you don't know much about that particular case. But Bernie Madoff was quite a character, and he's quite a character, still is, I suppose. But anyway, we'll listen to that thing tonight. You're listening on your computer, or you can listen on your cell phone if you'd like to do that. You know that you can play back every one of these shows. They're archived. You can save them to your computer, to a disk, to a memory stick, and you can play them any place you want. And we do know that there are some criminal justice instructors around the United States that do use some of our archive shows. All the shows on Blog Talk Net Radio Network are the same way. So there should be something there that you should like. Well, tonight, Audrey, you have Bond Joke. Last week was our special show devoted to Dr. John D. Collins. And we're still sorry about his passing, and we pass on our sympathies to his family. But Jack was a guy, Jack, to all of us who knew him well, was a guy that touched many lives, and we're certainly going to miss him. So, Audrey, we didn't have a joke last week, but now's the time for a joke. What do you have for us tonight? This one's about drinking? Okay.
Professor Haley. Tonight's blonde joke has the girls showing up at the local pub and placing their drink orders with the bartender. I think our listeners will like it. Here it is. A blonde, a brunette, and a redhead went into a bar and ordered their drinks from the bartender. The brunette says, "I'll have a B&C. The bartender asks, "What is a B&C? The brunette replies, "Bourbon and Coke." Next, the redhead says, "And I will have a G&T. "What's a G&T?" says the bartender. The redhead answers, "That is a gin and tonic." Finally, the blonde decides to order and says, "I'll have a 15. The bartender replies, "What's a 15? The blonde responds and says, "A 7 and 7.
Okay, but she was close. Very, very good. 15. Thank you very much, Audrey, for that joke, and that's a good one. We'll keep that one. Ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, we'd like to play the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms public service announcement, as we try to do every week, in order that we can reach the criminals and the street thugs, and they will hear this message and go turn in their firearms. And, of course, we've reported over the last several weeks a couple good gun buybacks. We had one in Camden, New Jersey, I believe, where they've given $200 a gun, no questions asked. And then the one in that was at the church in Detroit, where they were simply giving, I think, something like 20. So it might be worth the drive to Camden if you have a whole stack of them that you want to get rid of. But anyway, Ohio Coalition, go ahead with your public service announcement.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and we certainly indeed hope that that message reaches the right ears and they'll take the proper action and make our streets streets safer, as they are pretty safe, actually. And I'll have a comment about that concerning our prison population and these strapped financial times. We still have a lot of people locked up in prison. We've been passing on green tips, and Emily particularly likes this, and Emily, we're going to continue this because I'm You know, this is the week of the Copenhagen Summit, and we're trying to save the planet, and we're going to pass on some things here tonight. Usually we have only one green tip, but tonight I actually have three. So if you can take these tips into your mind and effect them in your life, and I think you'll do your part in saving the planet. The first one is this. It's pretty simple. Don't take the rap. What's that mean exactly? Well, if you're buying things that are all wrapped up and packaged in little plastic bags and little cans and all that business, every time you can, choose to not take these items in a wrapper. Now, let's use this like a drive-through restaurant. Let's suppose you like ketchup on your Whopper or something like that. Ketchup comes in those little nasty bags that have to be disposed of and endanger the environment. So I'm suggesting at the drive-through lane, perhaps maybe you can just sort of hold out your hand and ask for a couple shots of ketchup, and you can, you know, people are known to lick their fingers, right? So that would help save the environment. And then I finally thought, and Dr. Collins made me think of this, you know, he wrote his doctoral dissertation on the use of sign language, and I'm sure he would approve of this. If talking, you know, allows you to release carbon dioxide into the air, the less we talk, then the less we're going to be polluting the environment, because CO2 is the enemy. And I'm suggesting that perhaps widespread adaptation of sign language would work. We could use the regular sign that the deaf use, or certainly there's a litany of different schemes of Indian sign language. And just think, if that catches on around the United States, not only will the world be more silent, be more pleasant, and you'll be able to hear the birds, but people will be using sign language and not talking as much, and therefore not polluting the environment. How does that sound, Doug? How does that sound? Does it sound pretty good? Well, it's up to you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to make this announcement also before we take a look at our news stories. You know, we opened up the Ohio Criminal Justice Oral History Association Journal site. It's ohiocjoralhistoryjournal.blogspot.com, but you can Google it and it'll come right up, Ohio CJ Oral History Journal. And we opened that up with and posted our first oral history here about 2 weeks ago now, and that was Dr. Bennett Cooper. We talked about him on the show before. He was the first prison director for the state of Ohio when it broke away from mental health back in the late 1960s. And very soon, perhaps this weekend, we're going to have posted our second oral history, and we have a couple others in line behind that one. And it's going to be Chief Steve Thornton. He's given his permission for this, and he's been a police officer for 35 years, and for about the last 11 or 12 years, he's been chief of the Wooster, Ohio Police Department. And very interesting oral history done by the police officer Matthew Fisher. Very well done. I commend Matthew for his job in that particular oral history. But we want to continue to add those, so you as listeners, if you have people that you think would be willing to sit as a subject here in the state of Ohio for an oral history, then we'd like to do it. It involves about 3 hours of people's lives. If they're the subject, you come out and talk to them a couple hours and then go back and transcribe, find out what you missed, and then go back for about one more hour and pick up some details that were missing, and then transcribe that all out, and you have an oral history, and a very nice thing for people to read, wonderful thing for the family members of the person who's been interviewed. Two or three generations from now, they can not only read about what their grandmother or their grandfather said, but they also can hear their voice through the audio that I always ask people to give their oral history subject a copy of the audio also. Later on, we might be able to do some audio on the website. If we get crowded, I think what we're going to do is actually move to a different website with a lot more load capacity. Let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news. There's certainly a lot going on here this particular week, and I'm going to crank up some of these things right now, and I think you'll be interested in several of them, I would hope. Thank you, Mike. We got it up there. One of the first ones here, I think, is very interesting news. Tonight we'll deal a little bit more with prisons than we normally do, but because of some of the death penalty news. But the prison population is up in the United States, despite a drop in 20 different states. Says here prison population edged up slightly last year, but the total number of inmates dropped in 20 states, and that included New York, Georgia, and Michigan. I think Michigan, it's probably dropping at near precipitous rates because the state has severe financial problems. But Justice Department figures show that overall state and federal prison population is at an all-time high of 1.6 million. Now, that's just prisons. State and federal prisons, will add the jails here in just a minute. But the rate of growth is slowing as states look for ways to cut the cost of justice, including people in jails where some are held to wait trial. The total number of people behind bars right now is about 2.3 million in the United States. And everybody says, well, is that the highest rate of incapacitation of any nation in the world? Well, it's we're high, but I don't think we're number one. But the prison population grew less than 1% last year. In the previous decade, the inmate population grew by an annual average of about 6%. So we're still going up. And, of course, you always have to bring in some academic to comment on news stories like this, correct? So Professor Ram Kanan, C-N-A-A-N, how would you pronounce that, Mike? Kanan? Yeah. He's a professor of social policy and practice. I wonder why they wouldn't ask a criminology professor, criminal justice professor. But anyway, he's from UP, University of Pennsylvania. He said the slowing trend showed that politicians were confronting a painful truth about prisons. They simply cost too much. Amazing. Well, you need to look around, Professor, and see some of the states that don't spend quite as much per inmate as some of the other states do. Not all spend about the same. I haven't looked at that data lately, but some spend as little as $15,000, $17,000 per year per inmate, and some are way up over, I think, like $50,000 per year. He says, but both liberals and conservatives are increasingly searching for alternative sentencing programs like, I hate to say it, but I'm going to say it, like treatment or monitoring. Treatment, the big T word, which can involve what? Is that ping pong therapy? Is it group therapy? Is it... cognitive restructuring? I always love that one. Well, we're going to restructure your thoughts and your brains. Or is it laughter yoga? It could be laughter yoga. I tried that out in a class here recently and had the whole class laughing. I said, wouldn't it be better to have prisoners laughing than it would be to have them growling? And I think it would. You know, we've tried about everything, electric shock, acupuncture, on and on and on. And all of them seem to work about the same. About a third of these inmates will respond to treatment, about a third won't, and about another third are going to change for the better, whether you do anything with them or not, and just leave them sit in the prison cell. So I'd suggest the professor to read up a little more on recidivism rates and how that sort of comes out. But the states with the largest increase in prison population were Pennsylvania, Florida, and Arizona. Pennsylvania, of course, was the start of the prison system, if folks don't know it. The Quaker prison, the old Walnut Street Jail in Philadelphia, was changed over to the prison of Eastern Pennsylvania. Then they built another one out west. But they're the ones that had the largest increase. Of the three states that lost the most prisoners, New York shed 2,273, Georgia 1,537, and Michigan 1,495. If I were guessing, I would have bet Michigan was probably going to be the top one, but maybe... Michigan is a little bit more sensible about at least letting people out than I thought they were. Right, another news story here I think is interesting. Ohio broke history or wrote history this past week by doing what? Yes, they executed for the first time an inmate, a murderer, and this murderer went his way by the new one-drug intravenous lethal injection. Most people realize it's normally a three-drug cocktail, and the last person that Ohio tried to execute here several weeks ago, they couldn't find a vein. They struggled for, I think, perhaps up to 2 hours looking for veins, and that's the three-drug cocktail. I won't go through all the details and what all those are, but it didn't work. But this one, there's some big controversy in courts. In fact, Kentucky stopped their procedure till they looked again at the three-drug cocktail to see if it's actually masking pain. But they're now saying, and many people are agreeing, that this one drug, one big triple knockout drug, is the way to do it. And our execution here in Ohio just went as smooth as it could go. Of course, the backup procedure was historic also. The backup procedure consisted of shooting the drugs into two muscles, two different needles into muscles, and that must be easier to find than veins, but they didn't need that. The guy went his way. In fact, his last words, he says, "I'm being paroled to my Father in heaven." So that's a nice thought. The inmate was Kenneth Burrows, age 51. He died at 11:47 a.m., according to Terry Collins, director of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction. He said the drug took about 10 minutes to take effect, roughly the same length of time as the three-drug cocktail. It took about 30 minutes for the execution team to find a usable vein after having inserted the needle several times into each arm. So they did, looks like they did punch around a little bit, but it finally worked. Now, the guy that didn't go, he's the one that killed, raped, and murdered the 14-year-old girl. His name is Rommel Broom, and he was convicted in 1984. He's been death row all that time. So I don't know if he has a new execution date or not, but it sounds like it's full steam ahead for the Ohio execution process, and I think they have two or three others scheduled. I think there's another one this month. I could be wrong about that, but I know there's some early in the year. I know this is going to make you sad, but such is life. These 9/11 cases that they're going to try in the regular criminal courts and not the military type of tribunals, they're saying that we don't have enough lawyers who are trained to defend them. One lawyer calls it the death list, a cadre of about 20 defense lawyers in New York who have broad experience in death penalty and other complex cases. They've gathered to represent these people who've done terrorist bombings in East Africa, drug-related killings in Manhattan and the Bronx, et cetera. They're very talented people. But now you've got people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others in the September 11 terrorist attack, and they're going to be arriving at the courthouse early this next year. And we may not have enough. Keep in mind, these are people who've already admitted what they've done, and what they're really doing is pleading not guilty so they can make their case in open court to the world. And that's going to be kind of a miserable thing to listen to and watch. But such is America, right? We provide everybody the thing to do. By the way, the justices, since I talked to you last, we talked about that honest intentions law. In the book that I was reading, Three Felonies a Day, How the Feds Punish Innocent People, or Citizens, the Supreme Court heard the appeals on that case this past week. Very interesting, and it sounds like all of the justices are kind of against this law. They're saying that this is really too vague, that this business of honest intentions, that almost any of us can engage in any type of practice, and probably will be charged with that particular offense. In fact, you're going to hear about working up the ladder tonight in the Bernie Madoff case. We won't be able to hear it all, but I think we'll break it up into two parts so that you can get it next week. Those of you who like the gun news, here's a different one. Colorado State University's Board of Governors voted unanimously this past week to ban concealed weapons on the system's three campuses, following the practice of nearly every other college in the country, but defying the wishes of the University Student Senate, which opposed the ban. Can you imagine that? This is an article in the Denver Post. The Student Senate was against this particular ban. The board, which cited the views of the university's public safety officials and the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators, which I've done a national conference with them, and we turned that conference into a book called Critical Issues in Campus Policing. But anyway, that's interesting. No guns on campus. And I think we'll probably end up with our news right there. We could go on with that story, but Mike, that one's too long, right? Right. Well, I'll let you do that one next. That's next week. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, what we're going to do now is listen to the case involving Bernie Madoff. And again, he pulled off. I'll let the narrator give you the details, but he pulled off the largest single swindle in financial history. And he essentially did it, what we think, by himself. It's a very interesting story, and those of you who are sort of inside the financial markets and understand all that business will get more out of it than the rest of us that stand on the outside. But, of course, criminal justice officials, the FBI, and others conduct these types of investigations on a fairly regular basis, and more power to them for bringing us prosecutions in that particular arena. So here we go with the Bernie Madoff case. Hope you enjoy.
Madoff is behind bars and isn't talking, but a Fortune investigation uncovers secrets of his massive swindle. The employees were transfixed. Standing on the mid-Manhattan trading floor of Bernie L. Madoff Investment Securities in late 2007, a half-dozen staffers stared up at the ceiling-mounted TV as CNBC aired a report on the mysterious Palm Beach death of a hedge fund manager who had been leading a double life. The police, it appeared, were even considering the possibility that he had been murdered. "Bernie," someone casually asked as Madoff happened to walk by, "have you heard of this guy?" Madoff glanced at the screen, blanched, and exploded. "Why the fuck would I be interested in some shit like that?" The employees recoiled. "I never saw him react like that before," says a Madoff trader who witnessed the outburst. It obviously hit a nerve. Such a loss of control was highly out of character for the boss. But the traders didn't know at the time that Madoff had an extraordinarily elaborate second life going on just two floors below them, one that was building toward an epic and inevitable explosion. It took a special path to get into the back office on 17, where Madoff was conducting his $65 billion Ponzi scheme. And even if a person could get in, there wasn't much to see. An antiquated IBM computer server kept in a locked room, piles of trading statements, and a staff of about 20 paper pushers and clerks. In retrospect, of course, there were clues, as a Fortune investigation has discovered. The IBM server, for instance, an AS400 that dated from the 1980s, was so old that some data had to be keyed in by hand, yet Madoff refused to replace it. The machine, which has been autopsied by the government, was the nerve center of the fraud. The thousands of pages of statements printed out from it showed trades that were never made. Then there was the man who ran the floor, Frank DiPasquale, Madoff's chief deputy on 17. He was a 33-year veteran of the firm with a rough Queens accent and a high school education. But nobody was quite sure what he did or what his title was. "He was like a ninja," says a former trader in the legitimate operation upstairs. "Everyone knew he was a big deal, but he was like a shadow." There were other mysteries, as we shall see. But even after it detonated 5 months ago in a fireworks display of betrayal and recrimination, Madoff's scheme, possibly the biggest investment fraud in the nation's history, has remained among the hardest to penetrate. Most commonly, white-collar cases begin with a quiet, behind-the-scenes investigation, followed by a series of deals with junior employees who are squeezed by prosecutors to cough up details about their superiors. Step by step, the prosecutors move up. Finally comes the denouement, the ringmaster hauled into court in handcuffs. But with Madoff, every aspect of that traditional narrative has been inverted. The case began with his flabbergasting confession, which set off the investigation. Madoff claimed he committed his crimes all by himself, but because they span decades and continents, a fog of suspicion immediately engulfed Madoff family members who worked at the firm, as well as employees and business associates. Now that fog may be about to lift. Fortune has learned that Frank DiPasquale is trying to negotiate a plea deal with federal prosecutors in which, in exchange for a reduced sentence, he would divulge his encyclopedic knowledge of Madoff's scheme. And unlike his boss, DiPasquale is willing to name names. According to a person familiar with the matter, DiPasquale has no evidence that other Madoff family members were participants in the fraud. However, he is prepared to testify that he manipulated phony returns on behalf of some key Madoff investors, including Frank Avellino, who used to run a so-called feeder fund. Jeffrey Picower, whose foundation had to close as a result of Madoff-related losses, and others. If, for example, one of these special customers had large gains on other investments, he would tell DePasquale, who would fabricate a loss to reduce the tax bill. If true, that would mean these investors knew their returns were fishy. Lawyers for Avellino and Picower declined to comment. Mark Mukasey, DePasquale's attorney, says, "We expect and encourage a thorough investigation." The emergence of this potential star witness may well stand assumptions about the case on their heads. Some people widely assumed by the public to have been involved in the fraud may not have been, and a small group of Madoff investors who appear to be innocent victims may not have been entirely innocent after all. But then, few things about the life of Bernie Madoff turn out to be as they seem. Chapter 1, A Business Dynasty. Before it all went to pieces, Bernie L. Madoff Investment Securities appeared to be a charmed firm run by a tight clan. People believed in Bernie. NASDAQ made him its chairman. The SEC appointed him to industry panels. Congress invited him to testify. New York Senator Charles Schumer stopped by the office in the run-up to the Iraq War and gave a rousing talk on the trading floor. Everywhere you looked, there were signs that Madoff and, by extension, his firm had special status. Bernie was even able to arrange with his friends, the Wilpons, owners of the New York Mets, for staffers to play charity softball games on the field at Shea Stadium. If Bernie was the center of the firm's solar system, the nearest planet was his brother Peter. The head of compliance and de facto chief operating officer for the Madoff's original legitimate trading business. They were a savvy pair with a long-established dynamic. They were the ultimate good cop, bad cop duo, says Christopher Keith, a former chief technology officer of the New York Stock Exchange, who worked for the Madoffs on a side project, and who acknowledges that he clashed with them. Peter was the hands-on brother, the one immersed in detail, and most of all, the designated tough guy. Peter was like 5 miles of bad road, Keith says. Bernie's role was to glide in at the end and make peace, says Keith, who compares him to the biblical Solomon. He was the type of person who was sort of above the fray, the wise man. Peter, now 63, was tethered to his BlackBerry. A lawyer by training, he was the driving force behind the firm's technology innovations. Though he couldn't write code, he could discuss software algorithms with surprising facility. Bernie didn't have a BlackBerry. He didn't even use email. He could barely turn his computer on. His PC was configured essentially just to give him financial news, says Nader Ibrahim, who used to work on the technology help desk at Madoff's firm. It was set up in a manner that the computer never shut off, Ibrahim explains. So the format on the screens, how his windows were set up, and everything like that would just come up the same way. If he were to touch the stock menu and something unexpected came up in front of his system, he would get all flustered and call us. Bernie and Peter were the first generation of the dynasty. The second was dominated by another set of brothers, Bernie's sons, Mark and Andy, now 45 and 43. Andy was the more cerebral one, with a better understanding of complex technological issues. But many viewed him as haughty and unapproachable, though those who know him say a kind person is concealed behind the reserved exterior. Andy survived a bout of lymphoma a few years ago. He is now in remission, and when he returned to the office, he ceased working on the firm's original trading operation and focused on other projects, such as the Madoff's foray into energy trading, a business neither the company nor Bernie was involved in. Mark was in charge of the main trading business at the time the firm collapsed. If he didn't have his younger brother's intellect, he had the people skills that marked him as heir to the Madoff throne. A frat boy, he was easygoing and low-key, occasionally driving his Vespa to work from his Soho apartment. In his younger days, he would accompany his fellow traders to the topless bar scores. There was no question that the Madoffs were the firm's royal family. Mark and Andy worked among their colleagues on the trading floor, but they sat on a raised platform, a few feet above everybody else, and even star employees knew that they could rise only so high. Still, for the most part, people loved working for the Madoffs. A surprising number stayed for decades. Bernie's wife, Ruth, was effervescent and gracious. She wrote lovely personal notes to employees. Bernie himself could be charming, even compassionate. In 2002, a rookie trader was seriously injured when he got hit by a car while training for the New York City Marathon.
I passed out and woke up in the emergency room, the trader remembers. When he came to, he says, I looked to one side of my bed and my mom and dad were there. On the other side was Bernie. But Bernie was moody, and he could make people uncomfortable. At times, he would stare wordlessly into space. One former trader remembers being at a holiday party when he noticed that Madoff was glaring at him from across the room, and glaring, and glaring. You in trouble? The trader's fiance whispered to him when she noticed the boss's icy gaze. Uncomfortable, the couple left early. They never got an explanation. And Madoff could be less than sensitive. One day, a female trader remarked to a colleague that she'd had a nightmare about being raped, not realizing that the boss was listening behind her. Bernie piped in, "That's not a nightmare, that's a fantasy." Bernie had his quirks, and to a startling extent, they colored the firm quite literally. When it came to the decor, virtually every piece of furniture, equipment, or decoration was black or gray. That extended even to the pushpins in employees' cubicles. Bernie had the manufacturer just send boxes of black ones, says Bob McMahon, a former employee. Madoff was even more obsessed, if that's possible, with cleanliness. Even while he was responsible for billions of dollars, it was not uncommon to see him dusting his office or the 2-foot sculpture of a screw behind his desk. One staffer recalls getting off the elevator to find Madoff, clad in one of his innumerable tailored suits, on his hands and knees in the lobby, straightening the rugs so that they were aligned perfectly. That was Madoff's third fixation. Everything needed to be symmetrical and in straight lines. When Madoff was in the office, all window blinds had to be aligned at the same height. All computer screens had to be arrayed at the same angle and position, and on and on. So insistent was he on perfect alignment that more than once he dropped his trousers in the office, startling female employees, to ensure that the line of his shirt buttons was precisely vertical. More than one writer had pointed out how odd it was that Madoff, a seeker of the parallel and the perpendicular, should have chosen to house his firm in the lipstick building designed by Philip Johnson and John Berger in the form of an ellipse. The Madoff firm had 2.5 floors in that building. The trading floor was on 19, and the software programmers worked on 18. Employees in those parts of the firm knew there was a different, lucrative business on half of the 17th floor, but they didn't know exactly what it did. We were all aware of this hedge fund that had had great returns for 20 years, recalls one trader. We knew it was statistically impossible to have the steady gains for which Madoff became famous. As a collective, we always kind of wondered, how the hell does he do it? Every person was curious, but that's where it stopped. You'd stop yourself from wondering. You'd say, there couldn't be anything bad. The Madoffs had such a name and such an aura. Chapter 2. Mom, Dad, and the SEC. Peter Madoff, a trustee of the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, wrote a line on that institution's website about his family's roots. My grandparents ran a Turkish bath in the area that served as a focal point for many new immigrants of different nationalities. Census and marriage records show that the Madoff grandparents came to the U.S. from Poland, Romania, and Austria between 1900 and 1905. Bernie, when he rode through the area many decades later, would occasionally point out places where his family had lived or worked. But though he embraced the family's gritty immigrant success story, he avoided talking about his own parents and his more suburban upbringing. Bernie and Peter Madoff were raised in Laurelton, a middle-class area of Queens. Located beyond the end of the subway line on the border of Long Island's Nassau County, Laurelton felt more like a village in those days than a part of New York City's. Families would run into each other at the local Chinese restaurant, the ice cream parlor, and the Laurelton Jewish Center. The Madoffs, the parents Ralph and Sylvia, the boys Bernie and Peter, and their older sister Sandra lived in a modest 3-bedroom brick house with a detached garage on 228th Street. A broad, tree-lined street with a grassy median. Little is known about the career of Ralph Madoff, and no member of the extended Madoff clan would discuss the family. Ralph gave his occupation as credit on his marriage license, and one of Bernie's high school classmates, Ed Heiberger, recalls that he was either a stockbroker or a customer's man. The latter is the equivalent of a client or account representative. Years later, he would work for his son Bernie's firm. Ralph looked like a truck driver, adds Joe Cavanaugh, an old friend of Bernie's, kind of a rough-and-tumble kind of guy, not the kind of guy you screw with. Ralph Madoff wrangled with the government on one occasion. Along with three people, he owed a tax debt of $13,248.28, about $100,000 in today's dollars, that caused the IRS to place a lien on the Madoff home. The taxes were assessed in 1956, but the lien was not paid off until 1965, after the house was sold, suggesting that Ralph was either fighting the tax bill or unable to pay it. Like Ralph, Sylvia had a run-in with the government. In August 1963, the Securities and Exchange Commission announced it was instituting proceedings to determine whether 48 broker-dealers, including Sylvia R. Madoff, doing business as Gibraltar Securities, had failed to file reports of their financial condition, and if so, whether their registration should be revoked. Then, in January 1964, the SEC dismissed administrative proceedings against a number of the firms, including Madoff's, in what appeared to be a deal. No penalties if you promise to stay out of business. What's mysterious is that Bernie Madoff's childhood friends don't recall his mother's being involved in stocks or bonds. For a woman to head her own securities firm in the early 60s was unusual, and given that the company's address was listed as the Madoff home in Laurelton, Bernie's friends would seem likely to have noticed the business. Yet they didn't, and it's impossible to know why not. One could speculate that Ralph, his name tarnished by federal tax troubles, decided to put his wife's name on the application to open a stock brokerage. Either way, one of Bernie Madoff's parents was involved in securities and got into trouble for it. And according to his friend Joe Cavanaugh, who attended law school with Madoff before both dropped out, Madoff knew he was going to go into that line of work from a young age. Bernie, he says, was always going to have this business. Chapter 3. Cash on hand, $200. Perhaps that explains why most people's memories of the young Bernie Madoff concern his extracurricular activities rather than anything having to do with academics. Most of them, for example, recall his side business of installing sprinkler systems, which he launched as a teenager. He was a very aggressive kind of kid that wanted to get ahead in life, says his high school classmate, Heiberger. He was a regular guy who was always hustling. Madoff achieved little distinction at Far Rockaway High School. He was a lifeguard and made the swim team, specializing in the butterfly. But even in this, he didn't excel enough to compete in individual races on a regular basis, according to the team's co-captain, Fletcher Eberler. Instead, Madoff swam in the team relays. The only other activity that Madoff cited in his senior yearbook entry was locker guard. This, according to classmates, was a variation on the role of hall monitor. During a more innocent time, the mid-1950s, when fears of student misbehavior centered on truancy and pranks rather than drug use and shootings, the future Ponzi schemer was deputized by school authorities to prevent horseplay in the locker area. One constant in high school was Ruth Alpern, Madoff's sweetheart. They were a couple, says Jane Cavanaugh, one of Ruth's old friends, from early high school, maybe even from when she was in eighth grade. Bernie was smitten by the ebullient, energetic girl, who also had an excellent head for numbers. Every morning he would pick Ruth up at home, and they would ride the train together to high school. Madoff left home to attend college, passed a lonely semester at the University of Alabama, and then returned, according to two sources, because he was pining for Ruth. He began commuting to what was then Hofstra College, 10 miles across the city line in Long Island. His studies seemed almost incidental. What mattered to him were work and family. The day before Thanksgiving in 1959, he married Ruth at the Laurelton Jewish Center. 2 days later, he found the time to fill out an SEC application to register his own self-named broker-dealer firm. He later appended a financial statement to the application. It consisted of 7 words: assets, cash on hand, $200. Liabilities, none. Madoff hadn't even graduated. That came in 1960, and he had a tendency to get flustered or tongue-tied around people. But he didn't lack for determination, and he had another quality which Joe Cavanaugh puts in earthy terms. I guess the word is balls. Chapter 4. The Under-the-Counter Market. Even as Madoff continued his schooling, he spent a year at Brooklyn Law School. He plunged into the securities business. 6 months in, he reported a single stock position, 12 shares of a company called Electronics Capital, worth a total of $300, but by the end of 1961, his initial $200 stake had grown to $16,140, according to his SEC disclosures. A significant sum in those days for a firm that consisted solely of Bernie and his wife bookkeeper, operating at first from a shared desk at her father's accounting firm. Madoff specialized in over-the-counter stocks, the unglamorous, mostly small company shares that didn't trade on an exchange. He was a wholesaler, a person who would buy and sell small company stocks to brokers whose clients were looking to invest or to exit a position. In those days, Madoff explained in a 2007 panel discussion, over-the-counter stocks were traded always over the telephone with no automation. So you would call a broker, the broker would call up over the telephone any number of dealers like myself, and there were hundreds of dealers around the country that were making these markets. This was not the staid, institutionalized world of the NYSE. Since they didn't trade on a centralized exchange and there were no technology to provide up-to-date prices, over-the-counter dealers could and did take all sorts of liberties with their quotes. A lot of people started referring to the over-the-counter market as the under-the-counter market, said Gordon Macklin, the late president of NASDAQ in the Wall Street history, What Goes Up. Madoff was successful from the beginning, and his capital account began mounting. By 1967, he was reporting $127,517 to the SEC. In 1969, it had reached $555,157, and in 1973, it was listed as $1.1 million. By this point, Madoff had also been quietly managing money for years. There was no hint of this on his SEC forms. But beginning sometime in the early 1960s, he had started taking on investors. It originated with a small nucleus of family and friends, and then spread outward in larger and larger circles. For example, Carl Shapiro, an apparel executive who had met the young investor and been impressed by him, gave him tens of thousands to invest in the early 60s. Shapiro would stick with him for close to half a century, losing around $545 million when Madoff's scheme collapsed. Another key figure was Ruth's father, Saul Alpern. He not only let his son-in-law share a desk at his accounting firm, but also channeled clients and friends to Madoff. Eventually, according to Michael Bienes, who joined Alpern's firm in 1968, Alpern began gathering smaller investors together and creating a fund that invested with Madoff as a single account. This was among the first of what came to be called feeder funds. Madoff was adept at subtly cultivating relationships with people like Bienes. The accountant had represented Madoff in a successful audit in the late 1960s. Then, little by little, Madoff began drawing him in. "I got to know him," Bienes says. "I once went swimming naked with him. He invited me to the New York Athletic Club on Central Park South, where members swam in the nude at the time. He asked me to come and meet him and get a rubdown. We didn't discuss anything, really. I think he wanted to get the feel of me, you know, and bring me into his orbit." Bienes evidently won Madoff's trust, and when Alpern retired in the mid-1970s, his feeder fund was passed to his accounting partners and became known as Avellino and Bienes. Around this time, Bienes recalls, Madoff invited him to the bar mitzvah of one of his sons. "It was a lunch," Bienes recalls, "a buffet lunch. And I was very impressed because he didn't go over the top. He was a wealthy guy, you know, but he did it in a very moderate way. And I remember my partner, Frank Avellino, and myself and Bernie meeting in the middle of the dance floor. And we were saying, 'Thanks for having us.' And he said, 'Hey, come on, we're family, aren't we?' And at that moment, he had me. He had me. We were family. Oh my God, I was in. It really took me because he had a presence about him, an aura. He really captivated you." Bienes, who ultimately lost his entire savings to Madoff, still seems dazzled decades later. Another part of the appeal, according to Bienes' lawyer, Mark Raymond, was that Madoff led Avellino and Bienes to believe they were his only investing client. "I honestly thought we were the one and only," says Bienes, who says that he and his partner jokingly referred to Madoff as our boyfriend. In those days, Madoff would tell investors he was employing a much different investing strategy from the split-strike-conversion approach that would later become synonymous with his fraud. Madoff explained the early strategy in a 1992 Wall Street Journal article. Before 1982 or so, Mr. Madoff confirms, investors' money was being used to engage in so-called convertible arbitrage in securities of such companies as Occidental Petroleum Corp., Limited Stores, Inc., and Continental Corp. Madoff invested in high-yield issues that were convertible into common stocks while simultaneously short-selling the common stock, the article explained. Investors then earned the spread between the higher dividend paid on the convertible securities and the lower dividend on the common stock, plus interest from investing the proceeds of the stock short sale. Even as Madoff was planting the first seeds for his future role as a Ponzi schemer, he got a first-hand lesson in fraud. He was fleeced by one of the great charlatans of the 1960s. The perpetrator was a con artist with the evocative name of Jack Dick, who was sanctioned by the authorities multiple times and yet regularly managed to launch new schemes. His largest and most famous operation was known as Black Watch Farms, which sold investments in Angus bulls in the days when tax shelters were the rage. Dick himself became a wealthy and prominent figure in society. The New York Times' Gay Talese chronicled a 1964 bull auction conducted by Dick that was attended by the likes of U.S. Senator Al Gore Sr. and a representative for former President Dwight Eisenhower. Newspapers described Dick's opulent life in a mansion that had formerly belonged to the mother of an owner of the New York Yankees. Then it all collapsed. Dick was accused of embezzling $3.2 million from Black Watch's bank, but died before the case could be resolved. Madoff, who had committed $85,000, was one of many left holding the bag. The press descriptions of Dick's downfall resonate today. "He's one of the most brilliant persons I ever met," said one victim quoted in a 1971 Wall Street Journal article. The article noted, "If he has any flaw," one critic says, "it's confidence in his own judgment that is so excessive it borders on a belief in his own infallibility." Chapter 5. A Bonanza in Software. Long before Madoff attained infamy as a criminal mastermind, he earned respect as a pioneer in electronic trading. Yet Madoff apparently wasn't satisfied with his place in history and was prone to embellish it on occasion. Such fibbing may be the moral equivalent of failing to plug the parking meter for your getaway car while you're inside. In Madoff's case, robbing a bank of $65 billion. Still, he felt the need to puff up his credentials. Consider how we describe the creation of NASDAQ. Launched in 1971, it was a primitive computer system that displayed stock quotes, hence the name, National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotations. The system simply listed the bids and offers. It was not until a decade later that it became possible to use NASDAQ to trade stocks. Said Madoff at a 2007 panel, "In about 1971, computers were showing up and being used. So we," meaning my brother and myself, "saw that there was an opportunity to bring automation in the over-the-counter marketplace and create some visibility and transparency in the marketplace. So we came up with the concept of developing a screen-based trading mechanism where prices would appear on a computer screen. That was the start of NASDAQ." The way Madoff told it, his firm and four others made a proposal to build a screen-based trading system, which then became NASDAQ. Then that went through various stages of automation, so that you were able to turn on your computer screen and any brokerage firm in the country would list all the dealers that were willing to trade the security and the prices. Then that eventually went on to where you could actually trade the security automatically. That account is largely correct except for Madoff's role in it, says Charles Dick Justice, who started with the National Association of Securities Dealers in 1968 and was its chief technology officer for decades and knows Madoff. He wasn't involved in the founding of NASDAQ at all. Asked about a separate Madoff comment that he was involved in the design of the NASDAQ technology, Justice says, no, he wasn't. According to Justice and others who played roles in early electronic trading, it was only in the late 1970s and early 1980s that Madoff made his mark. And when he did so, it wasn't because his firm created the concept of electronic trading, it was because the Madoffs were among the first to recognize the value of the idea and design software that could trade stocks electronically in seconds. "If you have a brokerage firm that advertises, they will get their trade done with you in 5 seconds, says one longtime Madoff tech employee. "That's because our system will get it back to them in 2. That's the innovation. Trading through Madoff was not only fast, it was cheap. Actually, cheap understates the matter. Rather than taking a fee for trading stocks, as NYSE specialists did, Madoff paid firms like Charles Schwab and Fidelity a penny or two a share for their orders, a practice known as payment for order flow. In those days, there was a prevailing spread of at least 12.5 cents between the price that a market maker, like Madoff's firm, paid to buy shares and the price at which it would sell the same shares. Using its own software, Madoff's firm was adept at hedging the risk that buy and sell orders would be out of balance, preserving its profit. So even if he gave away a penny, Madoff could still make a tidy sum. The allure for customers was obvious, and these ultra-cheap, fast electronic trades were among the things that helped discount brokers like Schwab and Fidelity slash commissions and bring stock trading to the masses. By the early 1990s, Madoff's firm alone was executing 9% of the daily trading volume of stocks listed on the NYSE. Madoff's realm was known as the third market. His firm specialized in trading big board shares outside of the exchange. Such trading had existed for decades, but Madoff's firm led the charge as it went electronic. He was viewed as the leading third market firm on the street, says former NASDAQ president Joseph Hardiman, who became close to Madoff. He was very much respected and listened to by his peers. His peers did not include the specialists of the NYSE. That group viewed Madoff with disdain. They likened order payments to kickbacks, and they were incensed at being placed at a competitive disadvantage by this outsider. "We are being forced to play full contact football and tennis whites," sniffed one specialist to the Wall Street Journal in 1990. The anger and condescension still linger today. "The Madoffs were poaching scalps from my plate," says one retired NYSE director. He dismisses Madoff himself as nothing more than a chiffonnier, a rag picker. Call it shabby if you want. Payment for order flow was legal.
We're going to cut it off there, and as it sounds like someone's reading you a book, is that correct? Well, actually, if you will go to flipmedia.com, that's spelled F-L-Y-P, flipmedia.com, you can actually see this Bernie Madoff story and hear it. It's not a book, but it's a VOOC. In other words, it's video, audio, text, and pictures, and flipmedia.com is an outstanding site, and they allow you to download the audio for their from their podcast link on that particular site, and you can hear the whole Madoff story. We might finish this out next week. Again, it's something I know virtually nothing about, and that's very informative for me, and I suspect it is for a lot of other folks that are listening tonight, too. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and we'll see you next week, and we'll be signing off again with Vera Lynn, and we'll meet again, I'm sure.
We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Happy, happy Tuesday.